Thanks so much for the invitation and the introduction. We're a small enough group that, let's do this interactively. I'll talk through some things, but I'll really invite you to wave your hand, disagree. I'll keep us on time so we break at 9, and anybody who needs to leave in the meanwhile, feel free. Understood, no hard feelings. But what I'd like to do in the next little less than an hour, is walk you through some of the lessons we've learned about working with communities. I have been doing this actually for a few decades. And I'm happy to say in working with communities all over the country that I keep finding the folks in leadership role are family docs. It's just been marvelous to see. There are some general interests, a fair number of pediatricians, but by and large, this movement, which really is a very large national movement, which is really, I think, gonna help solve the issues that we all struggle with of how to make our healthcare systems responsive to our communities. We're picking up new partners and friends in family medicine's leading it. But first, let me share our disclosures. I have none. In fact, I have no economic tie to that book either. We all waived any fees or royalties, and the Beaumont Foundation underwrote the press run, so you could basically get it at the cost of the printing. So you're welcome to copies. It's also free online. We got Oxford Press to give us permission to post it on the Duke website, and I'll talk about that. So let's talk about what's really there. What I'm gonna do is very briefly just review the forces that are behind a shift from healthcare to health, and what's driving that. And you know most of those, though I have some of you that may be new. Talk about the dynamics underway, because they're complex. Describe examples of successful partnerships, and we have many. We have actually over 1,000. I'm not gonna do 1,000. And then talk about some of the practical steps we've been able to find, because we've been studying that here at Duke with partners for a number of years, trying to develop what works in what settings, so that it can be scaled up, and it is scaling up. In fact, it's scaling up really fast. Again, this is really actually 40 years of work. As a family doc working with the Durham community, we helped launch the medical home movement in North Carolina, part of that group. And actually, the department ran Medicaid for the central part of North Carolina for over 20 years. Just finished that in the last year. So we were in an unusual setting as a family medicine department of having all our usual functions, but we actually ran a Medicaid network on behalf of the state. So we had all that infrastructure and all the data. So what I'm gonna be sharing is kind of how we use that data and those connections, first in our neighborhood, and then across North Carolina, and then across the US, and now actually with about 40 countries. Okay, first language, because language turns out to be so important. When I talk about population health, I mean the health of everyone. So the classic definition is the health outcomes of a group of individuals, including the distribution of these outcomes within the group. So health equity, health disparities fits in here. In fact, it's a central part. The goal that's underway across the United States is to shift the dialogue from talking about healthcare to talking about health. What would it take? What would it be like? Can we even envision healthy people and healthy communities and what that would look like? Right now, our dialogue is around healthcare and healthcare costs. The movement is from healthcare to health. Here's what's driving it. First one, of course, you know, it's money. You know, we spend more money than anybody else in the United States on healthcare. You know that. This one, unfortunately, I can't get a better slide, so let me just point out that the bottom, it's showing how much money we spend, but the other one is life expectancy. And life expectancy in the United States has been falling off that of every other industrialized country. And actually, over the last 2 years, it started to take a downturn. By the way, how many of you know that life expectancy in the US has taken a downturn? Good. Now let's see how many of you know this one. Well, first, this is just a blow up of the life expectancy. This is for women. Now, how many of you know that it's particularly dramatic shift, in fact, a downturn for women, and that women in the United States now are dying earlier on average than their mothers? How many of you know that? Isn't that interesting? By the way, I've done this all in most of the states, and almost always I find that's true. Folks aren't aware of these shifts. Now, partially that's because they're subtle, but the US mortality rates are actually starting to go up. People are starting to die early, and it's particularly some groups, women and minorities. Steve Wolf has a great article out, if you haven't seen it, in JAMA last week, just pointing that out in even more dramatic fashion. I just added this 2 days ago, that we're seeing that downturn. Well, in this graph, it's a downturn. People in the U.S. are starting to die early, and yet we spend so much money. Now, you may go, yeah, okay, that's interesting. Let me tell you, it's interesting to governors. It's interesting to legislators who are paying for Medicaid about why are they paying all this money, and yet their communities, their voters, are not healthy. In fact, they're dying younger. So that sense of community engagement around why aren't we healthy is starting to pick things up. Now, I mentioned that this pattern of people dying earlier is complex. This is changes in female mortality rates over 10 years, 1992, 96 to 2002, 06, by US county. Blue means women are living longer. Red means they're dying earlier. What's the pattern? First, had any of you seen this map before? That's interesting itself, isn't it? So this is where you live, where we live. Women are dying early, and half the counties, by the way, of the US are red. Anybody see a pattern to that? Maybe political. California, but we got California, we got Montana is red. The answer I usually get is who people voted for in the last presidential election. The colors are not voting patterns. But there is an interesting tie, because the folks who are dying younger are feeling like the system has abandoned them, and they are, in fact, more likely to vote for radical change, however you want to take that. But the underlying reasons for that is part of what we're trying to dissect out, and where I think family medicine has a real role in understanding what's going on in our local communities, because it's not uniform. Take another step. Colorectal cancer in the United States, this one's a 30-year pattern. There's a baseline rate of colorectal cancer. That's why we do screening. We need to do screening. I got this from the American Cancer Society, because it turns out cancers locate two. This is excess mortality. And in 1970, it was mostly the upper Midwest, upper Northeast. But now it's localized in three areas. Anybody recognize those three areas? Why is colorectal cancer now hotspotted in three areas in the United States? One, we don't know. They are all industrialized river valleys, but that may not be causative. We just have an association. But it does raise the question, if you're a family practice and you're in one of those hot spots, do you know it? Are you doing particular outreach to those areas in trying to understand what is making those rates so high in those hot spots? So part of the agenda here is to start shifting the discussion from national rates of illness, saying what are the rates in your local community, and as family docs, as health systems, how do we engage in this very localized sort of interaction around causal factors? One more, this is my favorite. Got this from the Virginia Health Officer, whom, by the way, the Virginia Health Officer, Norm Oliver, is a past chair of family medicine, UVA, and so he's now leading this work. I got this from his predecessor. This is Stroke in Virginia. They did this map as part of the Million Hearts campaign, because we're trying to get everybody to really focus on, especially in the practices, around screening and treating hypertension. This is everybody age 35 and over who died of stroke, was in a hospital, died of stroke, which is almost everybody, over a 4-year period. It's mapped to geography. For those of you who don't know, I used to live here. That little blue area at the top, where's my pointer? Oh, I should push the right button, that helped. That's DC, that's Charlottesville, that's Roanoke, that's Norfolk, that's rural, that's rural, that's rural, that's rural. That's mixed, that's a little wealthier, that's definitely wealthy, that's wealthy, that's wealthy. What's the pattern? By the way, 7 standard deviations. This is real, folks. 7 standard deviations. No practice knew that. No hospital knew that. And no public health group knew that. It was too big to see. What's the pattern? Excuse me?
living near North Carolina.
Oh, you're good. And in fact, because I live in North Carolina, that pattern continues into North Carolina. And we would like to know what Virginia is doing to kill the people, good people of North Carolina. And I am not teasing. Guys, this is a lot of people, a lot of premature mortality. And we didn't know it, A. And B, we don't actually know what the reason is. I can point out, I've been studying this for a while. I went out to NIHS about it. The Roanoke River starts here and flows down and continues as the Choate into North Carolina, and the pattern follows the river exactly. But why would a catchment area of a river, what does it have to do with stroke? We don't know. But I can tell you, a million hearts, we're going, man, these folks know how to treat hypertension. These folks clearly don't. So we need to use one to teach the other. And that may actually be true, but it's not that relevant. The issue is, what's making that area around Roanoke 7 standard deviations higher? And what's our role, what's our health system's role in trying to deal with that, whatever it is? Okay, one last one. Anybody here from the Bronx? Okay, this is the Bronx. Well, this is a map of the Bronx. Okay, so you can see the interstates. This came up because there's a state innovation model in New York City, and they were failing to meet their benchmarks for quality improvement. Does it sound familiar? And they were struggling with what can they do? So we did a convening, they asked me to come talk to them. I said, well, why don't you look at your own data, but look at it clustered. So Montefiore Health System actually worked and has a very good primary care network, gathered all their data on asthma COPD admissions and mapped them actually to address. And that's this map. They found a 30-fold variation across the Bronx by address. And I went, huh, we didn't know that. But neither did any primary care group, neither did the health system, neither did public health. There's one group that knew it. It was not ER nurses. Nobody in a health system recognized there was a pattern. Who did? School. By the way, those red spots have chronic absenteeism rates in the schools of 65%. So schools recognized it, but they didn't know what was going on. One group knew what was going on. The moms who lived in those hot spots, because their kids were missing school every day because of asthma. And the official answer was that we have gangs in our schools. And the moms are going, yeah, we got gangs. Our kids are not staying out of school because of gangs. They're staying out of school because they're sick. So the moms sued, started working. They identified the pattern. They actually got the data from the school board on absenteeism rates. They mapped it, and they started suing landlords because they said it's the mold in the housing ducts that are doing this. So they started suing the landlords. And then when we did a convening of public health, primary care, the primary care network, the state innovation model, the moms were in the audience. We invited them. And they got up and said, well, let us show you our map, which wasn't as pretty. Their map of chronic absenteeism where the kids were sick and this map were the same. So Montefiore went back, and this is a map now clustered to apartment complex because many addresses are in the same. That's a 300-fold variation of asthma rates by apartment complex in the Bronx. Wow. And again, the practices didn't know it. So what the moms did with Montefiore was actually say, we're gonna start case managing the kids, but we're also gonna take this data to the housing authorities and actually get the housing projects cleaned up. Now, the moms were really worried when the housing projects get cleaned up, folks would raise the rents. So they actually got the banks involved to do microloans with the deal that they would clean up the housing projects and they would not raise the rents for the people who live there. The reported reduction in asthma rates out of Montefiore was just under 90% in 2 years. Cool. Okay, guys. Well, give me another intervention known to mankind, known to you, that reduces disease rates by 90% in 2 years. There's one. What is it? You've all had it. Excuse me? It's not flu vax. Flu makes a difference, depends on the year, but it's nowhere close to 90%. You've all had it. Oh, introduction of penicillin. That's a good one. I hadn't heard that one before. It's probably right up there. Polio vaccine. MMR is close, but and that's not quite, kind of to your point, it's not quite fair because polio vaccine actually eliminates disease. But that means this intervention, this working with communities, sharing data, looking at root causes and intervening can have an effect as big as some of the biggest changes we've seen in public health and healthcare in this century. So this is big stuff. So this is scaling really fast. In fact, it caught the attention of CDC. So they have taken all their data sets, all their public health data sets, and if you have ever tried to get data out of the CDC, it's a little problematic. It's now available online mapped. So you can look at your home community called 500 Cities. And I'll give, because that's just in Sacramento, this is hypertension in Sacramento by census tract. So they got this, and interestingly, folks in Sacramento didn't actually recognize how big of a one little area they had. But you can see this for mental health issues. You can see this for cholesterol. They've got all that data. Now, to be fair, some of it is imputed. It's calculated as opposed to direct measurement. So you can't use it for tracking. But you absolutely can use it where you live, unless you're too rural, to target the interventions you might want to do or to go out and work with communities, because it may be that many of the people that you're trying to improve health outcomes with by interventions in your office actually live near each other, and it might be a lot more effective to go to them. So what's come out of this is the idea that maybe it's time for a new form of prevention. This is an article that came out by John Auerbach. Saying we do traditional prevention, the sort of things that we do in the office, the evidence-based, and we do big stuff in the community like fluoridation of water. Maybe it's time for something in between that's really targeted, data-driven interventions around high-need, high-risk groups, because we have so many of them, and that's where much of the problems lie. By the way, what would you guess are the characteristics of those targeted groups? Linda? They're the, tend to be the minority communities. So this ties in this whole issue of health disparities, health equity. Those are the communities we end up working with. It weaves that in quite nicely. So let me give you an example of how this works in reality. I mentioned that Duke had been running, the department had been running a Medicaid network. We realized years ago that we had a cluster of people who lived on the other side of the railroad tracks and actually would drive, walk, take a bus, take a car, get a ride from that neighborhood and go to the Duke ED. So we were getting pinged by the state all the time because we had high ED rates, something you guys have been worried about. And we did interventions in the office, we went to the ED, and we did we did educational interventions, no impact. So then somewhere along the line, we had the bright idea, maybe we should go actually talk to folks in that community. So we actually did meetings for 2 years with that community. It is on the other side of the tracks. It actually was founded by James Wall, who was the black assistant to James B. Duke, who was the founder of Duke University. His family all grew up around that, became a textile community. Mostly African American, increasing Latino, low income, high ED use, a lot of behavioral health problems. We basically said, what do you want? What would work for you? By the way, 37 churches, this is messy stuff, and they all said, oh, we know what we want. We want Duke to build a clinic in our church. 37 churches? I don't think so. So we actually worked with the community action groups, with FQHC, Planned Parenthood, the ministries, neighbor associations, and we said, look, we'll work with you to find a solution that works with you if you can agree on it. And after 2 years, we actually got agreement of that group as our first intervention to actually build a community clinic staffed by a nurse practitioner, backed up by a family doc, that would be of, by, and for that community. Boy, it's a high crime neighborhood. It was then. We had no theft during the construction of that clinic. By the way, why was there no theft? The community saw it as theirs. We were building it for them. In fact, we signed this, the Waltine Neighborhood Clinic, with the Duke part small, because we wanted it clear this was us supporting their health, not us telling them what to do. So we opened it with one nurse practitioner. The ED rate plummeted so fast that the hospital ER director called me to ask me whether I was trying to shut them down. So about a third of the patients to this day would have gone to the ED. We've had to expand it 4 times. It continues to this day, funded by the hospital. Why the hospital funds it? We now have these multiple ones of these scattered around Durham, and the hospital pays for it. It's over $1 million a year. Why in the world would a health system pay for a clinic? We're not a Medicaid expansion state that mostly takes care of uninsured people. Go ahead. It reduces readmissions and it reduces ER. So language matters. I had to learn Medicare speak. I had to say, look, we're gonna reduce your average, I can't do it, it's been too long. Your average length of stay for your uninsured patients so that you can backfill with better insured patients. And he ran the numbers, our CFO for the health system, he said, oh, this is dirt cheap. I mean, why didn't you tell me this in the first place? I would have done it a long time ago. ER care, I mean, it cost $50,000 to build a new ER bed. He said, your whole building, build a bunch of them. So it runs this day. Now, just to be clear, the hospital every year says we're going to close them down. I go for it. You're still overcrowded in your ER. I mean, if you want to inflict that on yourself and you want the community to go up in arms and start parading in front of you, it's yours. You're paying for it. You can do what you want with it. He goes, oh, okay, maybe not here. So it goes to this day. Let me add this another one. How am I doing on timing? I promise I'd catch you guys out. Well, we're good. Okay, Just for Us is perhaps our most famous program. I'm a family doc, and we're doing these community clinics, and I got a call from the senior center in the community saying, how come you don't like seniors? So point here is, one, you have to have a thick skin. I love seniors. I am now one. But they said, well, I said, what? I don't get it. What gives? They said, well, you never come visit. And that was true. Other than an occasional home visit, we don't go to the seniors. And seniors live in naturally occurring retirement communities, NORCs. And they were right. So I said, okay, we'll come visit. So we came and they said, you know, we don't get to your offices very often. By the way, we did a sweep. We used some medical and nursing students to do a sweep. And we found that the average age of people in this high rise were 70. The average person had 10 major conditions. 44% had a major psychiatric disorder. All were homebound. 84% African American. Most had no family support. Most did not graduate at high school. Average income was $7,000. They had to pay 25% rent, so they were living on $5,000 a year. Meals on Wheels delivers Monday through Friday. They had no food on the weekend, except what they stored up. What in the world can you do to help this group? But they all had primary care docs, 100% of them. How often did we see them? Not very often. This is the person who shows up Friday at 4 without their meds. You don't have a clue what's going on. So we're going, oh, what are you going to do? We had a host of partners, you can see again, including our housing authority, FQHC, Council on Seniors, Mental Health Agency, Health Department, Social Services. This is a journey you do as a team, and our Center for Aging. So I mean, I was just going, oh, what are we going to do? So I've learned that when you don't know what to do, ask. So I said, well, what do you want? They said, well, we can't get to you because it takes 2 weeks to schedule a wheelchair van. So we just run out of our meds, and then we go to the ED. What do you want? I said, well, I think you need to come to us. I went, 350 can't run a clinic. This isn't going to work. And then I said, well, wait a minute. Let's really try and do this. So what we thought about and ended up doing was actually putting a nurse practitioner backed up by a family doc. That's Robin Ali, our family doc, with one of her patients. And we would do a voluntary program. The patients had to consent, and their primary care doc had to consent. Well, we would bring that NP and that family doc and geriatric social worker team to that clinic. We did an experiment. We would bill Medicaid, or if these are duals, dual, would bill for it, and would collect what we got. But both had to consent. Every patient consented, save one who was hallucinating, so we didn't think that was valid. She needed care. And every doc consented. Okay, why would a self-respecting family doc consent to have a nurse practitioner he never met see his patient? And we said, look, well, back then we'd fax you your notes, now it's electronic. We'll send you the notes, and you can always override us, but we want you to be their doc. We're just going to be the first outreach. Everybody consented. Why did they consent? Would you consent?
Yes.
Why would you consent? You don't see them anyway. So, yeah. So we started going door to door, and here's our outcomes at a little bit over a year. Inpatient utilization dropped 68%. ER rates 41%, ambulance costs 49%, prescription costs went up 25%. We tracked all the money because we had the Medicaid data and we had the health system data. It didn't save any money. It exactly balanced, but it decreased in ER or inpatient utilization by such a striking amount. And until last year, this low-income, low-literacy minority population had better hypertension control than the Duke faculty. What I learned from that is sometimes the problem is us. You can educate that group all you want. Sometimes we need to listen to them and provide care the ways that they want it. So this is scaling, this idea of using the data, looking for hotspots, going out and listening is the only case scaling up. The Boston has done this with the asthma program, and they reported out a 80% decrease in asthma admissions in Boston in 12 months. I mean, guys, these are big effect sizes. I mean, when if our QI movement, we were trying to get a couple of percentage points. In this work, if you can't hit a 50% reduction, now again, it's a targeted audience with a targeted condition. If you can't hit 50% in a year, it's time to try something different, because this stuff really works. And then this is new. This is actually Cincinnati Children's Hospital. We've been talking to them, and they actually mapped all their data for hospitalizations. And they said, you know, kids who get admitted tend to live near each other. There are hotspots for admissions in our communities. It's not uniform. Wow. And when they did the partnered intervention, especially around asthma, they were able to have a multi-year sustained reduction in ER rates. So this is not a one-time event. You can actually continue it, and it sustains. Okay, so this is starting to get some attention. CDC was interested. HRSA was interested. So CDC and HRSA actually got together and said, okay, is there some space between primary care and public health we should be focusing on? And they asked the Institute of Medicine to do a report about whether those two agencies could work together. And we studied programs. I was part of that group. Kevin Grumbach was too. Programs all over the country. We actually found hundreds of programs, very few of which were sustained. But we did find a handful that were sustained, and that was written up in this first IOM report. And the ones that were sustained and successful had common characteristics. One was there's agreement between the community, the health system, public health, about what they're trying to do. They were trying to improve health. It was around health, not healthcare, health. The community was always engaged. It wasn't just the leadership, it was broader. It included the political action groups because they were the political forces that sustained it. The leadership was aligned. They agreed this was important. They didn't do the work. They trusted others to do it. But we need to know the leaders were aligned. They designed for sustainability from day one. They didn't do a pilot. In fact, this is one of our key lessons that we've shared with folks all over the country, is figure out when you figure out what works, you need to have also known how you sustain it so you don't disappoint your community by doing experiments that work and then you walk away. So designed for sustainability, I'm gonna talk a bit about that. And they all use data. Most of these, we're tracking, we're pretty close to real-time data, especially with EHR, so if we can't see something working in a couple weeks, it's time to try something new. These are fast iterative. So these are not your classic QI programs. These are actually pretty fast and dynamic, and you flex them as you go. And this is what the model looks like. This actually comes out of county health rankings that's been adopted by CDC. The community's in the middle. And all of us are wrapped around it. Public health, healthcare, government, community development, nonprofits, educators, business. So it's a team effect, and it's really putting the community, especially those that have poor health outcomes, in the middle and saying, okay, what would work? Now, there are a couple of partners I'd like to point out in here. One is public health, and the other is business. So there's a really active movement now about engaging large and small employers in this by including health systems as employers. Now, why? We're finding businesses eager to participate. Why are they eager to participate? Why?
To decrease the cost of ED visits.
Well,
The
one, it decreases ER costs. The other is it decreases absenteeism rates. And the productivity increase actually is greater. When we look at this couple. So the reason businesses are doing this is because it increases the productivity of their staff. So they are real interested in productivity. So whether it's Walmart or IBM or a small bakery in Portland, folks are going, mine, if I can keep people so the kids are happy, their parents are happy, and they can be at work and not worrying about the family, this is good. And then the foundations have really are pushing this. And in fact, I don't know to what extent SDFM is talking to foundations about engaging this, but this is hot stuff across the grant makers in health. This is an example that I was quite engaged with. We actually got quite a few foundations, including Robert Johnson Kresge, to Beaumont, to actually work together as foundations. By the way, they don't work together well. And we kind of talked to them about, you know, we're asking communities to work together. We need to practice what we preach. So they did. They agreed to pool money and do what's called Build Health, now in its third iteration. Build stands for Bold, Upstream, Integrated, Local, and Data-Driven. These are two-year programs that give a grant to a community agency. The community group has to propose, and they're highly competitive, about how they would improve health outcomes in 2 years and sustain it. So it's competitive. The first year we did it, there was some question whether anybody would actually apply for it, and we worked with the advisory board, and we actually overflowed the advisory board phone lines with the level of community interest in this. So anyway, they get $250,000. The health system has to match the money, so they have $500,000 that has to go to the community, and then they do the proposed intervention. We've been staffing that here at Duke with County Health Rankings and with the Brevington Institute of Oakland. These are some of the current funders. But this has really gotten into the state foundations. So Colorado Foundation is deeply engaged with this. Kresge's involved. New Jersey Health Initiatives. And this is currently we have there are 55 projects. So by the way, almost always there's no academic health center and there's no family medicine group engaged with this because they're really focused on the community. On the other hand, we've really been encouraging groups, the coalitions that propose these, to actually work with their practices, nearby practices, as key partners. And I think that's an opportunity. And then the states are getting it. And I'm just about through. So states turn out to be really important. We saw the geography differs. So I've been going to the state health officers meeting for a while. And the discussion is really an example here in North Carolina. Mandy did grand rounds at Duke for Duke Family Medicine. And the state of North Carolina has decided it's no longer buying health care, it's buying health. And that's a huge shift. So it's going to take all its money as a state and say, how do we actually improve health outcomes? There are a few groups that find this problematic, like health hospitals. But it's starting to play out. Part of that is investing in advanced medical homes, so giving practices the tools. This is actually how do we build an infrastructure so the work of improving health, the practices are part of, they're key, but we want to reduce the burden on the practicing doc. We want to build an infrastructure so that you can be good docs and you can get the people you see, the services they need, get them referred to community groups. We want to build it around the practices, not in the practice, or connected to. So advanced medical homes are key. It's really, we want the practices to have a larger role in managing health outcomes. We're doing statewide screening for, I call them social drivers of health. So we actually did a two-year program to get all the practices to agree, including the FQHCs, where we're doing a subset of repair, around uniform screening. But we don't want the practices to have to do all the screening. You got enough to do. So we're actually building an infrastructure so the screening gets done by the managed care organizations and community groups, and the practices get the results. And now people come to you unscreened. Yes, we still want you to screen, but we're trying to reduce the screening rate. And then we're building an IT platform, and I'm chair of the board that's doing this, that actually takes all that data and gets people screened, identifies the resources they need. We're working with 4,000 community organizations in North Carolina. So if you screen positive, you get referred to what you need. It does eligibility testing. So if you need housing, it'll refer you to a housing group. And it tracks, and if you don't get picked up and case resolved within 24 hours, it'll move to the next agency. So it tracks along, and it keeps the practices involved of what's happening. So you have a dashboard where you can see that roll out. It's by the way, this is real. We have $12 million of implementation funding, and we're in about a third of the North Carolina counties already. We'll be statewide, all healthcare providers, 4,000 community agencies by the end of 2020. So it's moving pretty fast. But it's absolutely nutsy. I don't know, on alternate days, I really think this is really cool. On alternate days, I'm terrified. Because trying to get 4,000 community organizations, by the way, the platform is free to the community organizations. And they love it because it reduces their workload. Because up to now, they've been doing cobbled together manual systems. This gives them an electronic system to track all their people and track referrals. And they don't have to do anything except go online. And use it. But it's all HIPAA compliant and on. And then the state has, in our last Medicaid waiver, recently approved, though not yet funded by the state, we actually have $650 million to pay for housing, food, transportation, counseling, support services for interpersonal violence for people who need that help and are on Medicaid. So the state is actually investing big bucks saying, we want to build an infrastructure for health, we want to tie it to the practices, but most of all, we want to make those services available to the people who need them, who are in those hotspots. So that's a state, but again, it's scaling fast. The VA is involved, the National Office of the National Coordinator, HRSA, Homeland Security. By the way, the banks are involved, Federal Reserve Board. I was talking to Chuck earlier. The Federal Reserve Board's gotten engaged with this. Anybody want to guess why banks care about healthy communities? Well, I didn't know this either. It turns out it's in their charter. And because of historic redlining about where they would make loans, they actually have some damage to repair. So they're actually deeply engaged. Federal Reserve of San Francisco is on the lead, though there are a number of the Federal Reserves engaged, about changing their loan practices, doing microloans, to these sort of projects to give them seed money to build up. So it's growing rapidly. CDC's has really been reorganizing about how they take all their programs and start weaving them together to support communities and the practices that serve those communities. That's us folks. So saying, how do we take all our resources and start making them support investments in communities? And you can see on the bottom, it's around social factors, physical environment, health behaviors, and clinical care. So they want to be available support, the ability of practices to understand disease risk in their local communities. We're working closely with them. And then last, this is growing really fast. I've been engaged with this playbook for 7 years now. When we started, we had almost no programs we could identify around the country, some from the IOM, but most of those, I think I'd mentioned it, were just one-time programmed. We just scanned it again with most of the big foundations and the state health officers. There are over 1,000 community partnerships we've identified, most of which do not include anybody in this room, which is, most of them are around 3 years old, so they're fairly recent. These are communities convening because they're tired of waiting. So they're taking, in this crazy time, there's actually hope. Folks are, in the usual U.S. way, when all else fails, we figure out something locally. They're actually starting to say, what can we do? And this is an opportunity for us to join that. We're finding them neighbors, counties. By the way, you can get a list of those 1,000. It's on our playbook website. It's called Find a Partner. We don't keep it updated. It took us a year just to put together a list of 1,000, but it's pretty current. And then we did the earlier book on primary care and public health together, which has some good ideas, and you're welcome to look at that. We're somewhere over 400,000 page views on that. By the way, the Find a Partnership, again, is on that web page. And then this is where we're at now. It's really about multi-sector partnership that works. Because we've been doing the support for the Build Health, working with all the states, many of the big cities, we really tried to put together all the lessons learned. I should mention again, all this waived fees, royalties, the Bowman Foundation underwrote the press runs because we wanted it available mostly to communities. And these are the chapters that are really about why this matters, collaboration, data, innovation, kind of a really different take on innovation is bringing in ideas from outside the field. methods of sustainability and finance, including braiding and blending, which is language that you need to know if you're going to be in this work. They're all policy and training, a little bit on training and workforce, so that's the smallest. By the way, the advice we give to medical groups at this point is that these coalitions want, well, three things of medical groups. One is good clinical care, yes. Anyone want to guess what the other two are? The only two.
Availability.
Oh, very, very, no, it's good. They want us present in the coalitions. They want us to be engaged respectfully and listen. What's the other one? I don't know anybody to guess. They want us to advocate with them. So they want us to be clinicians, they want us to be part of the bigger coalition, and they want our voice in advocacy because people will listen to us when they won't listen to the community. I'll give you an example. In Durham, North Carolina, we saw a cluster of obesity, hypertension, coronary artery disease, stroke, all in one very poor, historically marginalized community called Northeast Central Durham. We did do a clinic with that group, but we're listing part of the community coalition doing this. And they brought up that there are something like 47 places you could buy alcohol in that neighborhood and no grocery store. The only place you get fresh fruits and vegetables were the gas stations. I went, okay, bad, but what, you know, what do you want to do? They said, well, we have a vacant lot. We would like you to help us advocate to make that vacant lot a grocery store. Okay, we can talk about all the medical downsides of this current model. So the community organized and fought for first a rezoning to make that available for commercial use, and then a tax abatement to bring in a full-service grocery store that would employ community members at a living wage. And that passed. So there is now, that food desert now has a grocery store. Now people, there's an active Parks and Rec group, the health department is leading walking clubs. The community is revitalized. The health system didn't pay for that. The family medicine group didn't pay for that. What we did is said, you're right, this is important, and we're with you, and we'll help. And we had the data, so we could talk about, help the zoning board understand why it was important. So we have real key roles here. We can really make a difference and we can be part of these larger coalitions who need us and want us, but it's going to be part of their partnerships in which we have key respected roles. And if this feels a little radical, let me point out that this has been part of family medicine from the beginning. The Folsom Report actually talks about communities of solution. The review of that in 2012 with the Folsom Report revisit really talked about the role of family docs in caring for the individuals who seek our care, but also the communities in which they live, work, and pray. So this is deep in our roots. Some of us old timers actually remember that. But I think part of the reason family docs are in such leadership roles in this nationally is because it's how we think. It's about listening to our patients and our communities. It's helping our patients find solutions that work for them and our communities as well. Whoops. So conclusions. Partnerships are growing really fast. They're growing around us. I would guess that in 80% of this room, there's a partnership working on health improvement in your community already. Look it up. It's being driven by desperation, by people feeling like they're not finding solutions. They're tired of waiting. It's being driven by those rising mortality rates. These partnered programs can be dramatically effective. This is fun. I mean, when was the last time you did something other than get penicillin? And a whole community got healthier. I mean, this is why many of us went to professional school, to medical school, to make a difference. These make a difference. And in a fairly short period of time. But the key aspect is to let the community lead, to be present, to listen, and to help the community find the solutions that work for them. And it works. Thank you.